His position in Book 10 is that happiness, which he had identified earlier on as the main goal for human living, happiness cannot be identified with pleasure, and yet pleasure plays an important role in human life and will be a part of what a happy life is. So his position is what we might expect, not enhancing the view of pleasure as the sum and substance, but on the other hand, not rooting it out, but insisting instead that it has an important part to play. To defend this position, Aristotle first tries to articulate the various types of pleasures that we have. Obviously, certain types of pleasure are associated with our bodies and are the things that we feel precisely when a bodily activity is still ongoing and is in process, or perhaps that we feel when we have finished. I think, for instance, when we finished a good meal, and some of the pleasure is in the eating, but some of the other pleasure is precisely in feeling full, that having a strong sense that we are well-nourished as well as tastily nourished. So he's mindful that some pleasures are bodily pleasures. He is also alert to the fact that some pleasures are truly intellectual pleasures. In fact, just looking at the texts of Aristotle, this is about half of what he wrote, and whether he's considering the nature of political constitutions or whether he's dividing up the various kinds of tragedies and comedies and analyzing them, or even, in fact, a good chunk of what Aristotle wrote, another half at least of this book, would be devoted to his biological works. And Aristotle clearly had a strong sense of the value of knowledge for its own sake, as well as knowledge that might be particularly useful for this or that project. So he has a very strong sense of what intellectual pleasures are. Mindful of both of these considerations, both legitimate intellectual pleasures and legitimate bodily pleasures, Aristotle argues that those who are suspicious about including pleasure at all in one's view of the happy life must indeed be wrong, but rather that pleasure does seem to constitute an important part of people's reason for living. But he is equally mindful of the ways in which one can become a slave to one's passions. And he thinks that concentration on these differences in kind between the various sorts of pleasures will help us to be alert to what it is that could make us slaves. Namely, that he's very alert to the fact that any one of the passions, so whether it be the passionate desire that we might have for food or for drink or sexual arousal, or the kind of passions that are sometimes the harder passions, things like angers, the jealousies that we might feel, the inclinations to have or seeing other people have them, that all of these passions are subjects for rational choice. They are things on which we can make a reflective and well-balanced choice if we are alert to the ways in which we are being tugged. You remember from our earlier discussions on it that the very word passion, sometimes associated in the Aristotelian tradition with emotion or feeling, but the very word passion as a translation of the Greek word pathos is deeply appropriate because it suggests that we are passive in how these feelings begin to arise in us. So whether it's the desire for food or the desire for drink or the desire of sexual arousal, whether it's a feeling of anger or a feeling of jealousy, we don't choose to have those feelings, but rather we're passive and they get stirred up in us. And then we must make some decision about what to do with them. And we must make a decision to pursue them or not to pursue them. And if we decide to pursue them in this way or in that way, to pursue them with this amount of energy or that amount. And all of these choices that we must make, he thinks, are choices that must be done by a reflective, reasonable consideration of where the passions are leading us. That the passions are not intrinsically suspect in the way they were for the Stoics, but neither should they rule the roost. They rather must be subject to the discrimination and the decisions of reason. That we must, as much as possible, learn to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes for a minute in order to come back and to see how we look and how they look, and in order to see, with the aid of vicarious experience as well as the aid of our own memories, what is it that would lead to a well-balanced life in which happiness, as the real use of all of the powers that are native to us, are more likely to be fulfilled? Well, here in the course of the 10th book, we find Aristotle making this argument, much as he did back in Book 1, Chapter 7. It was the argument that we discussed at that point, calling it the proper function argument.